This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 2016 was a drama-filled year, from space scientist to bioengineer. There were ups and downs and gravity that amazed us, twists and turns that hardly fazed us. News that was fake, social media too, rockets that landed after they flew. The climate got hotter, phone batteries blew. Hear this hour, our year in review. Our panel of judges has chosen its stories, each selected from large inventories. So without much further ado, I present our experts here just for you. Rachel Feltman is science editor at Popular Science. She joins me here in our CUNY studio. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thanks, Ira.
Maggie Hirth-Baker is senior science reporter at 538.com. She's based out of Minneapolis and joins us by Skype. Welcome, Maggie.
Lovely poetry, Ira.
I don't know. Thank you. It was a stretch. David Pogue is a tech columnist for Yahoo Finance and correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. He joins us from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Hi, David.
Hi. I didn't get the memo. Are all our answers to be in rhyme?
Well, if there's one person who can do it, it's you. So I'm very happy to have you with us. We want to hear what science stories that grabbed our listeners' attention this year, or what really flew under the radar and should have been covered more. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can tweet us at SciFry. Rachel, for the past 100 years, physicists have been chasing gravitational waves, and this year that hunt finally came to an end, right? We heard that chirp.
Yes, it did. In February, the scientists at LIGO, a facility designed to detect gravitational waves, reported their first success. Gravitational waves, of course, are those ripples in the fabric of space-time that emanate from everything, but particularly strong waves come out of, you know, large events like the collision of a couple of black holes, and that's exactly what scientists caught a little less than a year ago.
Yeah, it was very, very exciting.
It was really exciting.
Let's talk about CRISPR. It's been a big topic for the past few years. What were the gene editing milestones that we hit this year?
Right. So in 2015, we heard about CRISPR a lot because researchers were announcing that they were starting to use it on human embryos, which was a big, shocking story. And 2016, we really saw CRISPR, just kind of come into its own as a technology that all genetic engineers are using and that they're going to be using for all different kinds of things. There was tons of research on treating different diseases, cancers, genetic abnormalities. And there was a lot of interesting genetic research that didn't use CRISPR at all. There was a team that created the smallest artificial genome ever from scratch, though a lot of researchers say that if we're going to create artificial life, it's CRISPR being used to knock out and edit genes that will really, mm-hmm. you know, come in handy and not necessarily building something from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Maggie, there was a patent battle going on around CRISPR, was there not?
Yeah, I believe there was. You've actually hit on something that I have not reported on,
okay.
But I do think that the CRISPR story is a huge issue this year, and mm-hmm. it's been, as we said, just really exploding with so many different things. And there was one story that I really liked, though, from Nature, from Heidi Ledford, that kind of stepped back from this big picture of like all of these new discoveries based on CRISPR and looked at the people who had led to those discoveries. And I think it's really interesting because what she focused on were the postdocs and the graduate students mm-hmm. whose work, you know, who haven't become famous, who in some cases aren't necessarily getting jobs really easily still, despite, you know, being on these papers that are changing the world. And kind of I thought that was really important because it sort of ties into this other bigger picture story about the job prospects for science PhDs and how you can even be involved in something like CRISPR and still find it difficult to set up your own lab as a, you know, sort of grown-up scientist while your work is fundamentally important when you're a student to getting any science done.
Yeah, and in fact, on the other hand, I saw this while researching this, I saw a home CRISPR kit is now available out there. That's kind of scary.
Are you sure you weren't mistakenly looking at something designed for hash browns?
Dave, speaking of hash brown, let's talk about hacking. Hacking breaches used to be big breaking news headlines, but this year it seemed like hacking happens every day now.
It's really not a headline anymore. It's just it's so frequently that it's the new normal. We just have to expect that that is the way things are. There will be more email, for example. We just need to throw that in the garbage bins of our brains. That was never designed to be secure. It never will be secure unless you and I both have encrypted email systems, which, you know, if we have an important company, we might. But for the public to expect that email is private, those days are over.
But what about all those passwords they tell us to keep making?
Well, that's the part I rail about. Everyone says, oh, you need a 43-digit password with letters, numbers, exclamation points, and Arabic characters, and you have to change it every month, and you can't use two of the same password. Even if we did follow all those rules, even if we did, all of these same things would have happened. Because they're not happening through people guessing passwords. You know, the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, all of those people were hacked by email. It had nothing to do with their passwords. It's that they were sent a phishing scam with a PH. You know, the bad guys said, oh, there's a problem with your account. Log in here with your name and password. And, of course, it directed them to a phony website that collected their names and passwords. It had nothing to do with having a complicated password.
That's how John Podesta's email was hacked?
Yeah, in fact, that's even funnier. His aide, his chief of staff, received the phishing note that said, you know, your Gmail account is under attack. You must change your password immediately. The aide forwarded it to Podesta and said, John, take care of this immediately. So he wasn't even the one who fell for it. It was his assistant who said, oh, this looks important, better change. And in doing, he supplied his password to the bad guys.
You know, we have now the Internet of Things and digital assistants. There was a recent story about police wanting to use data from Amazon Echo in a murder case, Dave?
Yeah, in Arkansas. I love this story. The police are under the mistaken impression that the Amazon Echo is recording everything in the house at all times. In fact, it transmits... it is listening all the time, but it doesn't transmit anything to Amazon until you say Alexa or whatever you've named its first name. So the police thought that perhaps Amazon Echo in this guy's house might have overheard the murder and might have given them a lead. But Amazon said, A, it doesn't record all the time, and B, we wouldn't give the information to you if we had it.
Hmm. And there are other cases of Apple iPhones being under surveillance. The police want to crack those open too. In other countries, other cases.
This was also the year where, you know, our gadgets versus law enforcement were becoming a big thing. That murder case, by the way, the guy also had a smart water meter. So an Internet of Things water meter. And the water company was happy to work with the police. And they said, by the way, this guy ran 140 gallons of water at 3 a.m. Wow. So you know why the patio was all wet this morning? I think he was washing down blood.
Whoa.
Wow.
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 Yeah. So the Internet of Things is basically putting witnesses in our homes. And we need to start thinking about whether
Absolutely.
We want this.
Maggie, Silicon Valley has been trying to get into the health business. There are all these companies popping up where you can send in blood samples. They get a read out of your health.
Yeah.
But it didn't work out so well for Theranos this year, did it?
No, it did not. So, you know, just to recap, Theranos was this company that, at the beginning of this year was valued at $9 billion, and they promised to return blood test results in just hours based on a couple of drops from a fingertip rather than what's normal, which is, you know, taking days to return results from vials of blood. And they were doing it at rates that were 90% lower than those set by Medicare. And all of that sounds really fantastic, right? But, and there's always a but, they were notable for keeping the way that their technology worked really, really, really secret. So there's never been a peer-reviewed research paper published on this, for instance, which is, you know, basically unheard of in the medical device industry. And then this year, it all sort of imploded with a big Wall Street Journal investigation that revealed that most of the tests that Theranos was running were not being done by their proprietary system at all, and that they were getting incorrect results that were causing people to go out and do things like change their medications could be really, really dangerous.
Rachel, speaking of water was in the news. Big, big news this year, right?
Yeah, you know, so we had a few stories that dealt with, you know, access to clean water and, you know, what our what future infrastructure is going to do to that. You know, we looked at what's happening in Flint, Michigan. You know, they switched over to the Flint River as a water supply, and they did not add chemicals that stop pipe corrosion. And so these old lead pipes, you know, they're being leached into the water, and lead causes all kinds of health problems, you know, pain, risks of all kinds of diseases, weight loss. And in children, it causes these developmental problems that are permanent. You know, a kid is exposed to lead and they're going to get lower test scores and have more behavioral problems for the rest of their lives. It's very upsetting. And for the town of Flint, there's really just all of this, these stopgap measures. You know, they're putting filters in people's homes, they're giving them bottled water. But all this time later, there's no movement to come up with a permanent fix. And the really upsetting thing is that there are a lot of towns experiencing high lead levels or other contamination issues just like Flint. And it took so long for Flint to get into the public eye. And a lot of these towns will never make it into the public eye. So it really raised the question of, you know, what does it mean for people to have the right to easy access to clean water? You know, what does it mean to take for granted that the water coming out of your faucet is safe for your children? So to me, that was a very scary story and continues to be because it's still ongoing.
Yeah, well, we'll follow that. We're going to take a break and talk lots more about the stories of 2016 on number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science. Maggie Kurth Baker, senior science reporter at 538. David Pogue, tech columnist at Yahoo Finance. Also CBS Sunday Morning. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the year's biggest stories in science and technology with Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science, Maggie Kurth Baker, senior science reporter at 538, David Pogue, the tech columnist at Yahoo Finance, author, and does a lot of stuff on all kinds of things. We'll get into a little more of that later. let's follow up a little bit. Let me finish our conversation about water. And let me go to you, Maggie, because water has been in the news in other places too, right?
Right. I mean, we saw the Native American community in the Dakotas really coming out against this Dakota Access Pipeline that would have run a little bit north of the Standing Rock Reservation on land that was part of the original 1851 treaty that was ceded to the Dakotas then. And I think that kind of to tie back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, that whole protest against that pipeline is part of this much bigger water access issue too, because if you look at the statistics, you know, 7.5% of Native homes don't actually have access to safe drinking water and sanitation. So you have this situation where a lot of Native communities aren't getting access to the kind of infrastructure that they need to have, you know, safe basic, you know, resources, but they are kind of being forced to take access and to take ownership of the risks of these kinds of infrastructure projects that they don't necessarily want and that they don't necessarily have a voice in. And one of the things I was really interested to sort of find out is that this is kind of part of a bigger push for Native self-determination and kind of tribal governance that is affecting a lot of things around the country. You know, you had another pipeline in Minnesota that got stopped because of Native protesting, and you had a deep water port, I think, in Washington that also isn't going to come to fruition because of Native tribes standing up. And I think you're going to see a lot more of these big infrastructure projects where Native Americans are pushing back against things and saying, you know, hey, our voices on this matter too. And that is an interesting thing. You know, it's more about, from what I have understood listening to people and doing some interviews, it should be less understood as Native Americans are just against development and more about Native Americans being against development that they don't get to play a role in, don't get to have a choice in, that just sort of gets dumped on them.
Moving on to a different topic, David, fake news been popping up. It's been talked about for a long period now. Last nothing, you know, nothing else but the last few months. Can Facebook get a handle on this problem? Is there a way for it to tackle it effectively?
Well, yeah, it's a really tricky, interesting problem, partly because what is fake news, right? When the fake news issue first popped up having to do the election, and remember, 44% of American adults get their news from Facebook. So this is an enormous, enormous issue. Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO, said, come on, you guys, the fake news really didn't have much of an effect on the election, and let's not overblow this. And he was kind of blasted out of the water by the public as being defensive, when in fact everybody seems to think it's more serious than that. He then posted another essay that makes a little more sense to me, which is, as he said, identifying the truth is complicated. So obviously Pope Francis endorses Donald Trump. That's fake. FBI agent investigating Hillary found dead of murder-suicide. That's fake. But what about rumor or gossip stories? You know, no one knows if they're true. Or what about stories that are very biased in their presentation of truth? They leave out the context that would have made something sound more reasonable. Let's say Hillary gets X thousand dollars for a talk. Well, her opponent gets even more than that, but nobody talks about that, or whatever it is. So anyway, so Facebook finally has taken three big steps to fight the fake news problem. Number one, and most important, Facebook and Google have agreed to stop offering advertising on fake news websites. That's why they did it. You know, they draw eyeballs and then sell ads on their sites to expose to those eyeballs. But if Facebook and Google aren't willing to place those ads, then there's no monetary reason to do fake news. The second thing they're doing is they will start letting the public rank these things as true or false. And those that are marked by the crowd as dubious, they will send off, and this is part three, to sites like Snopes.com and the AP, who will inspect these things and weigh in on whether, in fact, these are true stories. So they are actually taking some pretty giant strides toward fighting it, but you're never going to be able to completely eliminate it, because who can say what the truth is?
Yeah. Let's see if we can get some truth out of our listeners. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255, to Ken in Hope Mills, North Carolina. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Ira. I've got a question about the future of Mars exploration and the search for life on Mars.
Okay. Rachel?
And just where are we at and where are we going?
Okay, good question. Rachel, you want to talk about, first, what a year it's been for space exploration.
Well, it's been an amazing year for space exploration. Not quite as exciting as the year before, because we had the Pluto flyby the year before. But, there was Juno entered orbit around Jupiter. We had the Rosetta comet mission come to an end. We have Cassini, which is around Saturn, getting ready to wrap up. In terms of Mars, it is a really interesting question. You know, the NASA's rovers are still going strong. We still have Curiosity and Opportunity hard at work on Mars, looking for signs that the planet could have been habitable once, signs of any ancient microbes. We have some upcoming landers planned. There's the Mars 2020 lander. A lot of people talk about crewed missions to Mars, actually putting people on there. And, we don't have any short-term outlooks for that, because nobody is really prepared to take those trips. Whether we're talking about NASA or we're talking about private space companies, we're just not quite ready. We're close to being ready enough to say, oh, it's a decade out, it's 5 years out, but we're just not there yet. So do I think that we could put people on Mars in the next decade or so? Yeah, but we have no idea what the timeline is on that yet. When it comes to the search for life on Mars, we continue to see really interesting research on the water that may have been on Mars in the past. Lots of indications that there may have been actually quite a large ocean on Mars at some point. Lots of interesting research being done on kind of seasonal water on Mars, this kind of briny water that might come and go at different times of year. The thing is that we're not going to send our rovers over there, because NASA has all of these and other international space exploration agencies have all of these rules in place to keep from contaminating areas that might have life. So basically anywhere interesting on Mars, we aren't going to go there. So yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff being done, but I don't think this is the year we're going to find life on Mars.
Mm-hmm. So Rachel, Elon Musk made a big presentation a few weeks ago where he laid out actual timeline and numbers and distances for a manned trip to Mars. I mean, clearly it was meant to be, you know, a publicity conversation starter, a moonshot, so to speak. Mm-hmm. What was the scientific community's reaction to his presentation?
Could I bet on this one?
Go ahead, Matt.
Because I've been doing some research for a series of stories that we're doing on Mars at 538, and I've been asking researchers and, you know, space law experts and all these people basically, so what about Elon Musk? And invariably, they've all basically said, yeah, don't know.
They said that about Einstein, too, I think.
It's true, yeah, and Galileo and, yeah, and everybody else. But, like, the biggest thing that I've heard is that, you know, this is going to be a coalition thing, that you, to actually deal with the costs of Mars and the development of Mars, you need more than one organization. You need lots of these different other groups working on it. And that a lot of the other puzzle pieces that you know, people like Musk aren't focusing on, so he's just focusing on the rocketry. A lot of these other puzzle pieces about the science, it aren't moving along very fast and aren't far enough along where, like, even if he turned out a rocket tomorrow, there's still a lot we don't know about how things like microgravity affect the human body over long periods of time, and that's pretty important stuff, too.
All right, let's go to the phones to Ben in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. A lot of folks from North Carolina today. Hi, welcome. Ben, go ahead.
Oh, hey. Thanks for having me, Ira. Really something that I thought was an interesting tech story this year is that I updated my iPhone recently only to find that it now knows what all the pictures of my dog look like or all the pictures of my girlfriend. And I think it's a really neat application of these sort of deeply trained neural networks, and the first time I've ever seen it, something that was so readily available and so good.
Oh, David?
Absolutely. I mean, the image recognition that you're talking about on the iPhone is actually a pretty feeble approximation of what Google Images and Flickr are doing. At some point, you should go to Flickr and type in, so you can type in pepperoni pizza or black and white jack-o'-lanterns. I mean, you can type in these incredibly specific text terms, and out of their billions of images, it will produce matching pictures based on what the computer thinks is in that picture. I mean, it is an astonishing leap, and you're absolutely right. It is so useful. When you need a picture of a person or a place or a thing, first of all, having it right on your phone is very handy. But in the larger sense, when you get onto these web-scaled image repositories like Google and Flickr, the possibilities are endless.
And, of course, this is owned by Yahoo, right?
Yes, I should hasten to add that. Flickr is owned by... By the way, one interesting thing about Apple's incarnation, Apple stresses that all of its calculation is done on the phone. Unlike these other entities like Google and Flickr and Yahoo, which keep your data on their servers, this is a privacy thing. Apple keeps all your pictures and the analysis of them on the phone. It's never transmitted. So privacy nuts can take some pleasure in that.
Well, and Amazon is already talking about a really interesting application of this, you know, very cutting-edge facial recognition. When they announced plans for their new grocery stores that will be, like, completely frictionless, people will come in, it'll recognize your phone, and then you just pull stuff from the shelves and you walk out and it charges you. They're talking about using facial recognition to track what your purchases are when you're in the store, you know, so that they know that, you know, the person with this face is the one who picked up 5 cans of tuna fish. And it's interesting because it raises a lot of, like, weird, you know, security, privacy concerns.
You think?
But well, but also I'm like really excited to not have to, you know, take out my credit card when I go to the store. So it's like whatever. They know what my face looks like anyway. I might as well get something out of it.
I have a face for radio. David, let's talk about, as long as we're talking about the phone, Apple made news by getting rid of the headphone jacks, right? I saw you
did
a wonderful Facebook demonstration of.
Yeah, I mean, Apple was actually not the first. They were the third big phone company to get rid of the headphone jack. And by the way, get used to it. The others will be getting rid of them too. Samsung will get rid of them next year. The iPhone already got rid of it, but they're talking about laptops being next. And the reason is really interesting. I got to interview some electronics consortium folks who said that every time one of these companies sits down to design a phone, they start out by doing a sketch of the components inside to make sure they'll fit. And the first thing they draw is the interior component of the head jack. All we see is the outside, the little hole, but inside the phone is this like 1-inch square block that's been in there since 1956. It hasn't changed, this technology, in 50 years. And they hate that because it prevents them from making the battery bigger or the camera better or making the thing waterproof. So by eliminating the headphone jack, Apple is sort of forcing us into the inevitable wireless audio future. I know it's a hassle for a lot of people. They give us adapters in the box. But really, once you have tried wireless headphones, it's...
You never go back.
You don't have to unravel them or untangle them or put them away. It's just super, super convenient.
You can drop them on the floor and lose them. We won't go there.
Right.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about the stories of science this year. One thing I want to see, I think Apple missed the boat on this. They put two phones on their camera, right? Two cameras on their phone. That would be something.
I hadn't heard about this one.
Two cameras on their phone. I thought, you know, the phone is so big. If you took one of those cameras and pushed it to the other end of the phone, you'll see that you can create a terrific 3D camera. You know, it's as wide as your eyes are.
Yeah.
I would buy that in a second and walk around taking 3D pictures instead of just 2D pictures. And then you have a little video player or something on your phone that plays it back in 3D through glass.
But
wow.
But what they did do, though, is something that I would argue has even broader appeal, which is similar. They use the two cameras and their half inch separation to distinguish the foreground from the background. And I don't know if you've played with the iPhone 7 Plus, the one with the two cameras, but it has this portrait mode that creates this razor-sharp foreground of the person you're photographing and then makes the background softly blurry, just like professionals do with their SLRs. They are
beautiful. I get you, Dave. I hear it, but it can't stack up to my idea of 3D pictures. Everybody, you know, instead of 2D, do you take video? Videos are so hot. Everybody wants a video. Why not make it in 3D so easily? But before we hit the break... let's talk about something else that might be on your mind, David. What would you think was the number one gadget? The number one gadget that was put out this year. You look at a lot of gadgets. I'm now giving you some time to think about it by talking about it. Do you have any gadget that stands out besides the phone, the wireless?
Yeah, I think there are actually two giant ones. One is the rise of the mesh Wi-Fi network.
Mm.
So instead of putting one router in our home and expecting it to blanket all the rooms, which never works and we get dead spots, these companies like Eero and Amplify and Google are now making sets of little routers that you evenly space throughout your house, and they create a giant roaming network with no dark spots. It's fantastic. And then the other one, I mean, I could talk for a whole hour about USB-C. This is the greatest thing. It's a jack. Okay, yes, I'm talking about a jack. I am a nerd. But this was 3 years in the making. 600 tech companies collaborated on it. It replaces the power jack, the video output jack, the audio output jack, the USB data jack, all in one tiny connector. There's no upside down to it. There's no wrong end to it. People call it the Jesus jack. You know, it does everything. And Apple has gotten rid of all the other jacks but this one on their new laptops. And people complain about abandoning Apple's proprietary jacks. But let me tell you, now you can get a $25 charger for your new Apple laptop from some other brand that works just as well. And they open so many possibilities.
Well, you do know your jack. So we'll come back and talk lots more about science innovations. We'll talk a little bit about the future. Take your calls. Our number 844-724-8255. We're going to take a break and come back with Rachel Feltman, Maggie Kurth-Baker, and David Pogue. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the big breakthroughs in science stories of 2016 with my guests, Rachel Feltman, Maggie Kurth-Baker, and David Pogue. And every year, unfortunately, we lose talented people who changed the world they lived in. This year, we want to remember a few of them and their work. Astronomer Vera Rubin passed away this week. By observing the rotation and shape of galaxies, she provided the evidence for dark matter.
I was not looking for dark matter. I wanted to learn how stars moved in their galaxies in a region far out. I guess I wanted to confirm Newton's laws. It seemed to me that this was a really neglected question, and I was always skeptical in the sense that I thought if you hadn't learned something, you just didn't know it. You couldn't just infer it. And up till that time, people would just draw falling rotation curves at the end of their observations. And that seemed to me a slightly strange thing to do because there were no data.
We also lost English chemist Harry Kroto. His discovery of Buckyball surprised him too, as he told us back in 2009.
As luck would have it, I met Rick Smalley at Rice University. Rick was jumping over the apparatus and excited about the breakthrough that he'd made, vaporizing metals and silicon. I thought, well, maybe you could vaporize graphite and simulate the conditions in a red giant star and see these carbon chains. Very simple idea. And we did that a year later with students Jim Heath and Sean O'Brien and Yuan Liu. And this crazy molecule just came out of the blue said, you know, look, forget those linear stuff. I'm the biggest guy on the block.
Harry Kroto's discovery won him a Nobel Prize and opened up the field of nanotechnology. We lost computer pioneer Seymour Papert. Professor Papert founded what would become the MIT Media Lab, and he created Logo. You remember that? Logo, a programming language to improve how children thought and learned.
I came to MIT after spending a few years with Piaget, the great innovator in thinking about children. This is what tormented me, that when you look at children in their first few years of life, you see they are powerful learners. They learn an incredible lot of stuff. And when they're in school, all of a sudden, you have to go to enormous lengths, not very successful procedures to get them to learn much less than they learned without being taught before. How could we change this? What's wrong with this? When I came to MIT, I had a mind-blowing experience, and the epiphany was realizing that I could use computers. This is the first time I had free access to powerful computers. I found that I was solving problems that I just hadn't had the energy or the courage to solve before. The computer was increasing my intellectual power. And then I thought, that's it. That's what's needed to change learning for children, to increase their intellectual power. And the computer's going to do this.
Computer scientist and educator Seymour Papert speaking at the MIT Media Lab. I want us to bring back our panel of experts to wrap up our annual year in review. Were there any overlooked stories? What should we look out for in 2015? Rachel Feltman of Popular Science, Maggie Kurth Baker of 538.com, and David Pogue from Yahoo Finance. Let me ask Rachel, one giant 800-pound gorilla in the room all year was the climate, right?
Yeah. 2016 was the hottest year on record. A lot of months were record-breaking months. NOAA just released their annual report card on the Arctic, and it pretty much flunked, which is, you know, to say that the surface temperatures and ice cover were pretty much as bad as they've ever been. One particularly striking climate change story this year, I thought, was the reindeer in the Arctic. So the thing is that when the winter is warm up there, there's less snow, which you would think would make it easier for foraging animals like reindeer to get food. But they eat lichen, and when it rains instead of snowing, there's this frozen ice cover, you know, on the ground, and they can't get to the lichen in the grass the way that they can poke through the snow. So we have tens of thousands of reindeer just starving. And then to make matters worse, because the summers are warmer up there, there are actually more reindeer being born, because at the times when they're reproducing, there's more stuff growing, there are more resources. So there are all of these reindeer that then when winter comes, can't support themselves. And we have these massive die-off events. It's only going to get worse. And that's one example. But, we're going to see more and more stories like this in the coming year.
And Maggie, one of the biggest stories that could affect the future of science as we look forward was the election. We still don't know what will happen to science with the new administration. do we?
Yeah, no, we don't. And some of this also overlaps with the climate change stuff, because there are a lot of climate scientists who are worried about their work being defunded, worried about their data disappearing. Talking to some folks who have kind of paid attention to this at the Climate Science Defense Fund, they're less worried about the data itself disappearing, you know, like these efforts to back it up to the cloud, and more worried about that intermediary step where data becomes translated to the public, where the public is actually given access to understanding what scientists are finding. And this is something that, you know, you saw in the George Bush administration. They had things like, you know, all of the references to climate change being edited out of an EPA report in 2003, or a report on the climate that was written in 2007, and then just never got published until the Obama administration came in. So these are the kind of things that I know I'm going to be looking out for. Papers that just sort of don't ever show up, departments that get shrunk,
And the administration looking to subpoena the work of the scientists, and they do that as intimidation.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, you definitely have situations with the Department of Energy where people were asked to name names about who's been working on climate change. And that is that's a pretty scary thing to sort of have around for scientists. Mm-hmm.
This is a really happy show you got here.
Yeah.
David, let me go to you about something, a warning and a sort of we need to know about. Batteries were big this year, especially exploding batteries that you can't bring on an airplane anymore.
That's right. The Samsung Note 7 made global headlines and really devastated that company. If you go to YouTube and you type in, you know, exploding lithium battery, you'll find all these videos of people poking at their batteries from their phones and tablets. And it turns out we've been carrying in our pockets really flammable, explosive chemical sludges. I mean, it's just unbelievable. The only thing that keeps these things from blowing our thighs open is the controlling circuitry. And Samsung evidently reached that point where they were putting too much power without enough control circuitry, and those things were catching fire and exploding. I don't know if it's permissible to plug relevant personal projects coming up, but I've just completed a year shooting a special on how we're going to solve the battery problem for Nova. It's going to air on February 1st on PBS. And what's just amazing is that lithium-ion batteries are not lithium metal. When we say lithium batteries, we're using a shorthand for lithium-ion. In other words, lithium-ion batteries hold not nearly as much power as an actual lithium metal battery with actual pieces of lithium in it, but those are just too explosive to use. At the same time, we're going to have to solve this problem not for our gadgets, but for the future of the world. I mean, electric cars and solar power and wind power are all, you know, going to be important in solving our energy and climate problems. But none of those will ever take off unless we come up with batteries. Like, you know, electricity is not stored like water is when you turn on your faucet. It's generated live when you turn on the lamp. So when the sun is not shining or the wind is not blowing, there's nowhere to keep that energy unless we come up with some kind of massive batteries for the grid. And of course, we need to improve batteries for electric cars, which are now selling fewer than 1% of all cars. So if we're going to solve these problems, the battery, the humble battery, is actually the key.
Yeah, it's got to be. We'll be watching for that special. It sounds quite interesting. Rachel, let's talk about Planet Nine.
Yeah, well, that was a really exciting
story. It's not the movie.
Story. No, that is a great movie. So it was a really exciting space story this year. You know, there's been research on Planet Nine before, not Pluto, not a dwarf planet, but the idea that there is evidence in the movement of the other planets and asteroids and dwarf planets in the solar system that indicates there must be some far-flung massive planet that we've never detected before because its orbit is just so huge that it's never been anywhere near us in recent history. So a paper that was kind of the most convincing argument to date on Planet Nine came out to much fanfare. And so now scientists are actually looking for Planet Nine. I think there are several scientists at Mauna Kea right now looking for signs of Planet Nine. And it's really like looking for a needle in a haystack because, again, the idea is that it's so far out with this strange orbit, but it could happen. We could find Planet Nine in 2017.
We're very proud at Science Friday because we have a reference to us in the paper that we were one of the motivations for actually doing the research.
Oh. So what you're saying is that at least some scientists will be looking up in the new year.
Okay.
Research on poems.
Hey, you're the one who opened with a poem.
I know. Do you have a poem you want to share with us, David? No, I won't.
I can't challenge you.
Let's talk about something that sort of was a shooting star, David, like a Pokemon Go. It came and went. You go in, get it, and sort of.
That was the coolest app. I mean, within 5 days, this one app was installed on 2% of every smartphone in the world. I mean, that is just an amazing mega hit. The designer had as his intention to get kids out of the house and off their couches and into the real world, interacting with their environment and other people by superimposing little critters on the real world as viewed through your phone. And it was a huge, huge hit. It worked. Although it was a summer hit, let's remember that it was a kind of an outdoor weather thing, that when it got cold, people stopped doing it. But I think that all this hype over virtual reality, putting on these Oculus goggles that isolates us from our friends and makes us hot and sweaty in the face, I think that's missing the really exciting technology, which is augmented reality. That's what Pokemon Go was, where you're seeing graphics generated by the computer superimposed on the real world. You know, the Microsoft HoloLens, for example, is augmented reality. And do you know that the Case Western Reserve Medical School in Cleveland is building a new building, and they will no longer have an anatomy lab with cadavers in it? They will no longer use cadavers. They're going to wear these goggles and look at their cadavers as virtual, upright, and by the way, living and breathing human bodies. And because it's augmented reality, a couple of students and your professor can all be standing in a group around one of these living corpses and, you know, pull apart some skin and say, see what this muscle does here, and look how the brain activity is controlling the heart and things like that, which you couldn't do on a corpse. There are some people who would maintain that a doctor's real job is to treat living patients rather than corpses.
I'm waiting to stand in the virtual waiting room. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And speaking of bodies, one of the stories we did not talk about that is one of my favorite topics is the microbiome. Very big, all kinds of news coming out just about every month about some connection to our health or society or whatever, leaving pieces of our microbiome around or substituting someone's for someone else's. Rachel, big stories all the time.
Yeah, no, there's been a lot of cool research. I think last year when we talked about looking ahead, I said that I thought that a bunch of people were going to try to, like, make these products to do, like, at-home poop transplants and stuff.
I remember.
For like trying to solve all kinds of problems that the research doesn't actually say that the microbiome transfers can solve. And I haven't seen a lot on the poop transplant front, but I am seeing a lot of probiotics and skincare products that claim to, you know, harness the secrets of the microbiome and, you know, feed the good bacteria so that they can fight the bad bacteria. And it is really interesting to see all of that you know, hitting the market, you know, while the science is really still catching up. Because I do think we are going to get some, you know, incredible health resources out of this microbiome research. But a lot of it right now is, like, supremely overhyped because it's just kind of a buzzword right now.
We haven't seen any real evidence from what we are reporting on the show that eating probiotics either actually affects microbiome.
Well, and I think even the best ones that have, like, the best research backing them up, it's only as long as you're taking them. You know, they don't implement long-term change. and they only change like the regulation of your gut. There's no evidence that taking probiotics like mm-hmm. makes your hair shinier, makes you right. feel better. And it's only on the days that you take them that they, you know, help regulate. So it's, like I said, a lot of it is very overhyped at the moment.
Maggie, I'm going to give you the last word today. What, looking forward to 2017, do you want to look into your crystal ball and predict something?
Oh, my goodness. So I am, I'm predicting a lot more focus on social science and what it tells us about people's behavior in the voting booth. Because one of the things that seemed to be just a huge story this year was everybody wanting to know why about everything that had to do with this extremely weird election. You know, you had everything from people debating whether you could diagnose Donald Trump with a mental health disorder, to people trying to understand what being a woman does and doesn't help, does help and doesn't help you at the ballot box. You know, if you're running for office, we had research about these really interesting new canvassing techniques where people go door to door and try to have Socratic dialogues on the doorstep to try to change someone's mind about a political or social issue. And for the first time, we're finding evidence that that can be done, which matters a lot because changing someone's mind is extremely hard.
Yeah. Right.
So I think we're going to have a lot more to see about social science and politics
right.
intertwining.
We'll be watching with Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science, Maggie Kurth-Baker, senior science reporter at 538.com, David Pogue, author, tech columnist at Yahoo Finance, correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Ruk Rotzkin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Our thanks to the entire Science Friday staff for an incredible year. Rachel Batten, Daniel Dana, Brandon Echter, Ella Fetter, Jennifer Fennick, Sochi Garcia, Sarah Goldfarb, Jen Kwok, Julie Leiback, Annie Nero, Daniel Peterschmidt, Christian Scotta, Chow Tu, and Ariel Zitch. Thank you all for making us such a wonderful success this year. Have a happy and safe new year. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.